You see it everywhere. The prosecutors are the villains now. The progressive prosecutors, and even some not very progressive prosecutors, are becoming the villain. You ready for that?
I think it's hard to say anybody would be ready for that. What people can expect from me is honesty, straightforwardness, communication. And I will do my very best to make sure if I do become the villain, it's for something that I've actually done. It is incumbent upon me to explain why I am doing things that I'm doing, because some of the things I want to do, like restorative justice, because this is actually what I've heard from victims and victim advocates, is that they want restorative justice on violent crimes as an option. And that's new. We don't have it here. There's a terrific program in New York that has it. And the rate at which people come back is 7%. And we have nothing like that. Our recidivism rates where people come back here are a third to a half to higher than that. But you have to explain to people what that's about and what it looks like.
This is a real thing. None of you have the balls to stop this.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now.
So how is the campaign going?
I think it's going really, really well. We have a fantastic grassroots team calling delegates. We've been doing that for months and getting a really good reception from people. And now that the precinct caucuses have turned into contactless, it's important to make sure people understand how to submit the form to be a delegate. Things are going really, really well.
All right. I'm going to roll into the show. This is the Wedge Life podcast, and we have cats. We have cats today. I'm John Edwards, your host, and our guest today is Mary Moriarty, who is a candidate for Hennepin County Attorney. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So we've talked a little bit about how your campaign is going. Hennepin mm-hmm. County is a big place. And I'm sure maybe the first thing you tell people when you introduce yourself is to explain what the Hennepin County Attorney is. What do they do? Why is it important? Why should people care? So give us your pitch.
Yes, a lot of people do ask that question. And so what I tell them is that the Hennepin County Attorney or Lead Prosecutor or DA, because I think most people think of the prosecutor as a district attorney, that's what it's called in other places. It's critically important because the county attorney decides who to charge, whether to charge, what to charge, whether to ask for bail, whether to allow somebody to go to diversion, what to offer them. So they completely impact whether somebody comes into the system and have a huge influence on what actually happens to them once they get into the system. So that role is critically important for individuals and our community to understand.
And so talk about your transition from being the chief public defender to being the Hennepin County Attorney. Like, you're in both roles, you're concerned about justice and fairness in different ways, obviously of different clients, right? So talk about that transition.
It's not actually different clients necessarily, because so many clients or people who are accused or charged in the system were victims at one time. You've heard the saying, hurt people, hurt people. But it is a completely different role. So as a public defender, which I was for 31 years and then chief public defender for 6 years, my role there was to represent one client at a time and be devoted to that person's particular interests. As county attorney, you represent all of the people in Hennepin County. not a particular part of the county, not certain people. But in each case, you really have to figure out what is best for the public safety of the people in Hennepin County.
So 2021 for me was a very frustrating year in terms of the conversation around public safety. And it became a kind of the police versus the elected officials, the blame game over like, have we been defunded? We don't have enough resources. Police would say we don't have enough resources. And the thought became like, well, it's because you've defunded us. And it feels like as I watch local news from around the country, that's one of the things I do on YouTube. It feels like the conversation has shifted towards prosecutors, like the police blaming prosecutors. You aren't charging people enough. You're not prosecuting what we bring you, or you're not charging the right crime. And it feels we have that locally with Choi and Freeman, obviously. How do you handle that? Is it true? I guess the question is it true? To what degree is that true? Because the MPD has stats that they put out about we've had this many people get out and commit a second crime or a third. To what extent is that true? Or is it a snow job?
Yeah, you know, my goal, and having been part of the system for so many years, I have seen the finger pointing happening a lot throughout my entire career. And in my conversations with people all over the county, Minneapolis suburbs, people say pretty much the same thing. They want people to stop pointing fingers at each other and sit down and figure it out. Ultimately, this is supposed to be about keeping people safe and trying to rehabilitate people as well. And so one of the things that I did actually was to meet with some police chiefs because I think that's important. We have to work together. And, you know, let me take a step back. So one thing that has been a little frustrating is that for me, I want to know what the actual problems are because that's where we arrive at solutions. So one thing that's been a bit frustrating for me is that I have heard law enforcement, and this has been repeated in the news, that the bail policy of the county attorney's office is responsible for people getting out over and over and over. And the frustrating thing for me about that is that's not true, because the bail policy that was actually implemented a couple of years ago covers 19 different property offenses, only first-time property offenses. There's not a violent crime or a person-related crime on there. There is car theft, but that has nothing to do with carjacking, a robbery, a gun, anything like that. And anyone who comes in on a first-time car theft is going to score really low or be a good score on the risk assessment and is going to get out. So there's nothing about those bail policies that is having any impact at all on people getting out and repeating and that sort of thing. But we certainly know there is a problem. We have these carjackings. Everybody deserves to feel like they're safe. And so rather than pointing to things that have nothing to do with that, it is important to sit down and look at the data and then see, well, are people getting out over and over again? Is it youth? I do know youth don't get bail. They're either detained or they're not detained. So they're held or not. And I have heard that when a youth comes in on a car theft, not a carjacking, they do get out. And there's a delay in about 6 months in them actually receiving help or any kind of programming. And that's not okay. You know, with kids especially, you need quick consequences. You need them to get help. That is something that the county attorney could change and something I would change. So that's just an example of let's figure out what the real problem is. There's no simple solution, and we have to stop blaming it on everybody else. We in the system have to sit down and say, okay, you know, for instance, why, I think I read a statistic that police were catching about 10% of people on carjackings. So why is that happening? What's the strategy that can be implemented there? And then what's happening to those people when they come into the system? Is it true that they're being released over and over and over and committing violent crimes? That's hard for me to imagine that adults would be doing that, because I know the judges really well and I suspect they are setting bail. But if there is a problem with repeat people, then we need to look at that because something isn't working. So my frustration is that people aren't sitting down together and looking at the data and talking to publicly together, and that there's a lot of finger pointing, and people are just tired of that. People don't want to hear it. You know, people who are in these positions are expected to work together and try to figure out how to keep people safe. And also, when especially youth come into the system, figure out ways of helping them with their trauma and not just sending them to prison for long periods of time or incarceration because they just get out and cycle back in. We really want to be able to work with youth so that they can address the trauma and other issues that bring them here, so that they don't come back into the system, so that they are safe and that people in the community are safe as well.
So here's an ignorant question. To what extent does the county attorney like administer intervention style programs? Like you talked about the 6 month thing that you would change that. But are those programs under your control? Because you're way downstream of like society's criminal justice system. By the time it gets to a courtroom, like a lot of bad things have happened. Like in terms of like funding and like creating programs, what is your role that way?
So I see the county attorney as having multiple roles. One is to work, for instance, with the Office of Violence Prevention. They have implemented some evidence-based practices that are shown to work, yet they don't have the resources that they need. One of those programs I participated in, or I was at a call-in, so I know how it works. So one thing I could do is advocate for funding for violence prevention and intervention. I can also use this position to advocate for resources and investment in our communities that are marginalized. But the question that, you know, going back to the why is it taking 6 months, to a certain extent, yes, the county attorney does, or the county contracts with certain programs to provide services. The particular issue here, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds, is that the county attorney won't allow people, or I should say, you know, the defense lawyer doesn't want a person to go into programming a kid and talk about what they did if that's going to be used against them later in prosecution. And the reason I said that that is within the control of the prosecutor and is all that they need to do, and what I would do is say, look, youth, I want you to get into this program now, as soon as we possibly can get you in there. And the whole concept is for you to take accountability. So you get in there, anything that you say, I promise, won't be used against you if we end up prosecuting you. By virtue of the fact that they're in the system, they already have a case anyway, there's already evidence. And so that's just an example of something that's completely within the discretion of the prosecutor that they should be agreeing to, and they're not. And that causes kids to be out in the community on car thefts, we're not talking about carjacking, without any services and without any opportunities for it to go to community centers because everything's shut down. And being kids, they're going to go back out and maybe, you know, take another car. So that, to me, the what's important is getting people the services they need as quick as possible, because that's been shown to actually work, to have very quick consequences.
Have you noticed the local news like mixing up carjacking and car theft a lot? I feel like it's being equated when one is a violent crime and one is somebody got into an empty car and took it.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying I was frustrated. The news is doing that, but they're actually repeating the same thing that law enforcement is saying, which is frustrating because they repeat the whole bail policy. I guarantee you there's not a violent person-related crime or a carjacking that there's any kind of policy that the county attorney's office would not ask for bail. In other words, somebody commits a carjacking, I guarantee you that the county attorney's office is asking for bail. They just are. Okay. So the frustrating thing is they're talking about violent carjackings and saying that it's the bail policy that's causing people to get out. And it just isn't true. And the reason that's important is if that was the problem, then we, you know, probably need to go back and look at that policy, but it isn't the problem. So what is the issue? If it's true that people on violent crimes are repeat offenders and getting out, why is that? You know, are judges setting bail? Are people posting bail? What's happening there? But we don't actually know that because people are, you know, conflating carjackings and car thefts and bail policies when that really isn't the issue. So I would agree with you on that. And I think, you know, it leads to the public being really frightened. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't be on carjackings. Maybe my mother lives in Bloomington. I don't want her to be one carjacking is one carjacking too many. But let's talk about the real problem. And let's not say things that aren't accurate. Let's sit down and figure out what the problem is and figure it out. That's what people want to see right now.
Let's talk about your Wikipedia article. Did you have any part in writing your Wikipedia article or anyone close to you? Because I know that's a common thing for candidates. I'm not accusing you of anything.
But, oh, no. I was just laughing because I think the first time I heard about it was my mother told me. Oh. She said, "Do you know you have a Wikipedia page?"
Is she proud?
Oh, yes. Except that she said that it says I was born in New Ulm and I was not. I was born in Benson, Minnesota.
We're making news. You were born in Benson, not New Ulm.
Yes. This is firsthand news. But it was actually my mother that told me that the page existed. I had no idea how they got created or added to. I don't use Instagram either, which is kind of revealing, perhaps.
Does your mom edit Wikipedia? Not an editor?
No.
Okay. What I wanted to ask about is there's the sentence in there that said you worked as a reporter before enrolling at McAllister College. Is that true?
Okay, let me put it this way. I grew up in New Ulm, and New Ulm had the New Ulm Journal, which was actually a daily newspaper at the time. And so I worked there over the summer, and my assignment was to go to county fairs and interview people of interest at county fairs. And so I wrote profiles on the pork queen and the dairy queen and the woman who won a blue ribbon for brownies. And so I hesitate to call myself a reporter. But if that's how you define reporter, yes, I
that's
did
how
do
I define
that.
Reporter. I've watched the TV news. That's journalism.
I have to say, you know, I did want to be a journalist. I think journalism is so important to our country. And I did want to be a reporter when I went to McAllister. And then I ended up studying history and political science and then going to law school. So it was something that really interested me. And I did get that experience in the summer of working for the journal.
Okay. I'm glad I cleared that up.
My mother's really glad, I'm sure, that you cleared up the fact that I was actually born in Benson, Minnesota, and not New Ulm.
Yeah, if anyone is listening to this who edits Wikipedia, I guess if your mom edited Wikipedia, she would have fixed that. So if anyone else is out there, get on Wikipedia and fix it. So let's get into specifics about what you would want to do differently as the next Hennepin County attorney. Mike Freeman is currently there. What are some policies you want to change from the way it's done now?
Well, I prefer to look forward at what I would do. And I think overall, I said earlier that prosecutors are, they represent the people in Hennepin County. They're there to do the right thing. And one thing I want to change culture-wise is I think there's a lot of pressure on the prosecutors who work there to quote-unquote win. And that can make it really hard for people to do the right thing when they may be evaluated or incentivized to win. For instance, there are a number of times when they had bad cases that they set for trial, and they would tell public defenders, well, you know, I'm sure my supervisor won't let me dismiss it. I know it's a bad case, or, you know, something of that nature. Or if there was a case where police conduct was bad, I've seen them defend or say something like, well, yes, I know the police officer punched the person in the face, but he still had drugs. So I think it's important to change that culture to do the right thing and make sure that people feel comfortable that that is what they're charged to do. I think it's really important to approach substance abuse disorder from a public health perspective and harm reduction perspective. Way too many people are charged on drug use possession of low-level drugs. And a lot of people end up going to prison on that because addiction is very difficult. And there's always been not a harm reduction perspective, but we'll put you on probation with conditions. And then when you use drugs or alcohol, we will revoke you and maybe send you to jail. And that's really not how recovery works, which I know, you know, I've talked about the fact that my stepsister died of an accidental overdose. She had some mental health problems and drank while she was on some medication. So it's been a particular interest of mine. That's one of the reasons why I chaired the Behavioral Health Committee in Hennepin County for 6 years, because I was really interested in finding options for people who were struggling with mental health and substance abuse disorders. So both of those would be things that I would want to change about the way the office functions. I also think it's really important to look at youth or juveniles from a brain development perspective. We know their brains aren't fully developed until 25, 26. And so they are very likely to be impulsive, be susceptible to peer pressure. We know they bring a lot of trauma to the system, and we're not adequately addressing that. I also know people are concerned about police accountability. And one thing, and I think when I say that, people always think of, you know, will you charge a police officer who shoots somebody or something like that? And I view it much more broadly than that. For instance, I think people think that there's somebody in the police department, especially MPD, looking at all the video and body cam. And there are thousands of hours, if you stop to think of how many police respond to a particular incident, thousands and thousands of hours. So it really is the prosecutor's office that sees more of the body cam. And I've seen a lot of body cam and video, and I've seen some policy violations there, minor, less or more serious. But I think those are things that need to be brought to the attention of police chiefs. The minor ones, because maybe that's the way you interrupt and prevent the next Chauvin from happening by intervening at an early time when police leadership might not have seen that relatively minor violation, but still something that's worth having a talk to a person or officer about. So I believe very much in working with police about providing them with video that shows violations of policy, so that they can document it and take action at an earlier time. There are a lot of levers that the prosecutor has. There was a police officer from one of the suburbs who had 6 cases thrown out by 5 different judges for violating people's constitutional rights. And after the 6th case, or when he was testifying in the 6th case, he was asked, are you aware that you've had 5 cases thrown out? And he said, yes, but I disagree with the judges. And I should say also that in 2 of those cases, the judges found that he had lied. They said he was not credible, which is judge speak for lying. And after that, one of the supervisors in the public defender's office asked a supervisor in the county attorney's office, what are you guys going to do about this guy? And the response was, we're not his employer. And that just can't be the case. Yes, they're not the employer, but they are the entity presenting that case. They decide whether to charge a case brought to them by a police officer who's had 6 cases thrown out, 2 because judges said that he lied. So it's a responsibility and an opportunity for the county attorney's office to be looking at that and trying to intervene. And if it in that type of case, you could say, you know, we're not going to charge cases you bring to us because you just keep violating people's constitutional rights. You've lied under oath. We just won't bring you to court. And I think that that's really important because as a public defender, I can't tell you the number of times I watched really serious cases fall apart because police officers came in who cut corners and it was very easy to cross-examine them. And as county attorney, I would want good police officers that do good work so that when you're prosecuting a serious case, you know, you don't have to worry about that police officer getting cross-examined and the case going south because of something that happened. So those are some of the things I would do. I could go on and on and on, but you probably don't have a couple of hours.
Oh, we probably do, but I know you're a candidate, so you have places to go and people to talk to. So lying under oath is a crime. Do you prosecute a cop who lies under oath? How does that work? That might put you in a tricky situation because obviously you work as a prosecutor, you work with the police, but I don't know. Do you prosecute cops who lie under oath in a case you're trying?
I think it depends on the circumstance. With body cam and video now, you see this happens a lot. You will see a police report and then you'll look at the video and the video does not support what's in the police report. Now, sometimes that's an innocent mistake because people's memory, you know, eyewitness is notoriously bad. And so sometimes, you know, the police officers just misremember. It's not anything pernicious, but sometimes it is. It is clearly there's a problem here and there's no other explanation. And now that we have that video, I think it's easier when a cop gets up on the stand and then takes an oath and testifies, if it clearly looks like that they are lying, especially when the judge finds that, we do have to take a look at that. And I think it's really important I've talked to probably about 170 people in Hennepin County since July, because I went on a sort of a listening tour and I said, what do you want to see in the next county attorney? And what I heard a lot of was building trust in that office. And I think the way to do that is building relationships. It is being transparent, accountable, accessible. Part of that has to do with the relationships you have with police. It has to be a professional relationship, no more, no less than that. And if you see some conduct, and I'm going to refer to the Jaleel Stallings case, you have to take action. It certainly appears from all the video that I saw that an officer or two should be investigated for assaulting Mr. Stallings. There's video that has one officer sprinting across the parking lot and kicking him in the head while he's lying face first on the ground. And we know he was beaten for about 30 seconds. They fractured his eye socket. That's a felony assault, unless that was an objectively reasonable use of force. And I certainly, at least in the video, don't see it. So if the prosecutor sees situations like that, you have to take action because no one can be above the law. And that's one of the reasons why people don't trust in the system in general or in that office. I mean, we still haven't heard the prosecutor say anything about that. Remember, Mr. Stallings was acquitted, so found not guilty of attempted murder. And the only reason the video came out is because his lawyer pushed to get it out, and the county attorney's office opposed the release of the video. So then the video came out and everybody saw what happened to him. And I think it was actually the reformer that reached out and they broke the story, but they reached out asking for a statement. And we haven't heard anything. And so people in the community are wondering, you know, do you stand by that prosecution? Do you think that was a mistake? What will you do about it? Did you think about prosecuting the police? Was there a problem with prosecuting the police? So there are a lot of questions there that haven't been answered. And it's the type of situation that further erodes trust in the office.
Who is the right prosecutor's office to prosecute the police? Obviously, Kim Potter and Derek Chauvin are being prosecuted by the Attorney General's office.
Right.
And so I think a lot of people would say Keith Ellison and his prosecutors have done a good job. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But what if we have a Republican attorney general who doesn't mm-hmm. want to do to prosecute police? Like, should it be the county attorney or should it be the attorney general? Should it be formalized one way or the other?
First, what I would not do, which the current county attorney has done, is to send some of those cases to other elected county attorneys. So we saw that situation in the Dalal Eid case, where the Dakota County attorney was sent that case. And then in the Winston Smith case, that case ended up in Crow Wing in Brainerd. I would not do that. If elected, I would be elected by the people of Hennepin County to make those decisions. They didn't elect the county, and this is nothing against the Dakota or Crow Wing County attorneys, but they weren't elected by the people of Hennepin County to make those decisions. So that's one thing I would not do. The reason those cases ended up with the attorney general, and I agree they've done an excellent job, is because of the lack of trust in the Hennepin County attorney's office, and that's a problem. I do think they should be prosecuted, or that decision should be made by the Hennepin County attorney. I do think that the AG's office has done a terrific job, but I will say they're not resourced to really do that. And I think it's been very difficult. They, if you remember in the Chauvin case, I think they had about 12 volunteer lawyers and people just volunteered their time. And in the Potter case, I think they had 2 lawyers on it because I think those are the only 2 lawyers that they actually have that do that kind of work. And they did a great job. But without the staff, it's really hard to do that. And I do once again think that the county attorney should be accountable. Those cases ended up in the hands of the attorney general because people were not satisfied that the county attorney would do the right thing. And there was no trust there. So that's something I would hope to build.
Let's talk about your old job as chief public defender. One of the things I learned towards the end of your tenure there was that you're not responsible to anyone in Hennepin County is not your boss, right? Am I correct? It was the State Board of Public Defense. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
And so they obviously ended your employment there in what seemed like politics. So should that change? Should the people of Hennepin County, should someone in Hennepin County have authority there and not the state?
I would say, I mean, obviously what happened to me was unpleasant and traumatic and all of that. But what I do really worry about is the staff. And I've always worried about that and salaries and resources. That's critically important to me. And so for people who don't know the history here, before the state took over the public defense system in Minnesota, each county decided how to fund public defenders. And Hennepin County always funded public defenders well. In fact, when I started, I was a Hennepin County public defender. We were actually in the same union as the county attorneys. So whatever they got, we got, which was a pretty good system. And unfortunately, though, in other counties, the other counties were not funding public defense well. In some counties, there were contracts. And when you have contracts, sometimes the low bidder gets the contract. So that was not good for public defense in other places in Minnesota. So the state board was created. They took over the entire system. I think it was 1996. And a lot of people objected to that because of what's actually happened, which is that every employee hired after 1996 is now a state employee. And what that did was create everybody who was a county employee, including me, was grandfathered in. And so that means that the office has 2 pay scales, 2 unions, 2 everything pretty much, but no longer was the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office getting the same resources and salary as the county attorney's office. In fact, we have a married couple in the office and just they have the same level of experience. One's a state lawyer and one's a county lawyer, and there's something like 20,000 or 30,000 difference in their salary. So it's substantial. You have brand new lawyers who are starting at far less than the brand new lawyers in the county attorney's office. People come out of law school these days with huge loans. And it just, first, it isn't fair. It's morale killing. You are working across the aisle from somebody who's making a lot more money, who has more resources. Because when the county was put into the state system, we weren't getting what was comparable to what the county attorney got. It was being divvied up among the rest of the state. So the state takeover was a really good thing for some counties. It actually turns out to be a terrible thing for Hennepin County. And you might have seen there was a legislative hearing, I think last week, on it. And there were a couple of articles in the newspaper. People are leaving in droves. The salary is a huge problem. Retention is a huge problem. And unlike when I was chief there, we used to be able to get, you know, between 100 and 200 applicants from all over the country because people really wanted to work in the office. And now they can't, they're having a really hard time getting people who want to work there. So, you know, my situation was my situation, but my biggest worry is really about the state of the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office in terms of really terrific lawyers, who many of whom have left, the salaries, and ultimately the clients in Hennepin County. They're the people that are hurt by this the most. So I am concerned about that. There does need to be some solution for that.
And it's all coming back to me now from when this happened. Wasn't one of the underlying issues that the state board had with you was that you criticized the system?
It was. I was at, because we actually are partly funded, or we were, the Public Defender's Office was partly funded by the county board, I had to make a budget presentation. And I had made a budget presentation and I had focused on the problems with the salary and people not accepting our salary, even though they wanted to work for us. And one of the commissioners asked me at the very end, well, what's your solution for this? And I said, you know, I think the county should take us back. And so, yes, I was disciplined for that. That was, and then when I came back, my reprimand, the first part of my reprimand was that I run every presentation past the state defender that I gave to the county board so that they could be sure I wasn't talking about salary parity. But the problem with that was it wasn't in my presentation. I was asked a specific question by a county commissioner and I gave an honest answer. But yes, it's been very clear that people who work for the state board do not want salary parity for our staff. And then that was a major issue in my demise there.
One of the things that's come up recently, talking about resources and under-resourced offices, it seems like maybe the Hennepin County Attorney's Office doesn't have enough resources to handle an increased caseload. Do you believe that's accurate? Do we need more funding for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office? More lawyers?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I know it was interesting to me. I read that they had shifted another lawyer or put two lawyers in charge of carjackings or something of that nature. I don't know if that's that they need more resources or they need to reallocate their resources. As I said, they prosecute a lot of drug possession crimes. And so how many resources are they putting into that versus violent crime and something like wage theft? So that's something I would have to look at the case numbers and see where those resources are allocated, what they're doing with them. So it's hard to say without all of those numbers, but I would look at the allocation of those. And I know I would be changing and shifting to, as I said, wage theft and focusing on serious crime. You know, there's another issue there too, which has been a cultural issue for a very long time. The county attorney's office will charge cases. They often overcharge them, but many people know that you don't get like the real offer until the case is set for trial. And so many cases get set for trial that are ultimately resolved on the day of trial. And that creates situations where both prosecutors and public defenders have something like 6, 7, 8 trials on a Monday because cases are usually set for trial on Monday. And nobody knows exactly which case is going to go, so it's hard to be prepared. Many of those people may be in jail, which has dramatic consequences for the person in jail and their family, and also costs a lot to people in the county. And so what I think should be happening is that if somebody's charged them with what they should be charged with, not overcharging them, if, you know, if you're going to make an offer 3 months from now on the day of trial, make it early on. You know, I remember talking to a public defender not too long ago who said, you know, my two trials settled today on the day of trial for the same thing we asked for a couple of months ago. And you think about the cost to the system, how much it costs to actually have all those trials scheduled, and the cost of trying to prepare for all of that. It's a huge issue. And so that's a culture that I would attempt to change as well.
Are you ready to become the chief villain on the local news during crime stories? Because I'm worried about that. I see it in California. You see it everywhere. The prosecutors are the villains now. The progressive prosecutors and even some not very progressive prosecutors are becoming the villain. You ready for that?
I think it's hard to say anybody would be ready for that. But I certainly, in my role as chief public defender, you know, I spent a lot of time in the community and people would say things like, you're a bunch of public pretenders. And I don't take that personally. And I would always walk up to people and say, I'm sorry you had that experience. Can you tell me a little bit about it? And often people would say, well, I've never had one. It's just what I've heard. But people's perception can be their reality. What people can expect from me is honesty, straightforwardness, communication, and I will do my very best to make sure if I do become the villain, it's for something that I've actually done. It is incumbent upon me to explain why I am doing things that I'm doing, because some of the things I want to do, like restorative justice, because this is actually what I've heard from victims and victim advocates, is that they want restorative justice on violent crimes as an option. And that's new. We don't have it here. There's a terrific program in New York that has it. And the rate at which people come back is 7%. And we have nothing like that. Our recidivism rates where people come back here are a third to a half to higher than that. But you have to explain to people what that's about and what it looks like. And it's not, you know, a couple of circles. That particular program in New York is over a year long and it addresses trauma. And so you have to explain why a victim of a violent crime would want something like that to help them heal. And so it's incumbent on me to be talking about that and to be working with people in the community and organizations, partnering to explain so that people understand. Because one thing that happens, and you've seen this over and over, something bad happens, as it always does, because the system is not, you know, you can't predict behavior. And then the one thing bad that happens, suddenly legislators are talking about, oh, we have to have new legislation. We have to do something. When very often it's a tragic situation, but really nothing different should have been done or could have been done in a way. And the laws are there in place to address these issues. So one thing I think we have to try to keep in mind is to focus on, you know, what happened here. Should we stay the course? Is it working? Is it not working? And I know what we've been doing isn't working. And so the answer to your question, nobody's ever asked it that way. I guess they have asked it in a why do you want this job kind of thing, or it sounds really hard or something like that. I've been asked, are you excited about this? And I always say, no, I would not look at this job as being something exciting. It's going to be really hard, really hard. And I've been a public servant my entire career for 31 years. I'm not a politician, so I'm not using this as a stepping stone for something else. And so I will be focused on making decisions that align with my values and are consistent with evidence and research-based practices. But, you know, I can't guarantee I won't be up at night. I'm not going to make everybody happy. In fact, I think a lot of the times you're making half the people unhappy. But the key is, are you doing the right thing for public safety in each and every case? And that's hard. It's really hard. But I'm trying to sign up to do that. I've surrounded myself with, I mean, we have just the best grassroots team, by the way, from all over the county, people who have joined us because they believe in something different for our community, especially now after George Floyd. I think you mentioned this, the conversation has shifted. We kind of went from a racial reckoning of sorts to we need to, you know, what you're hearing now is we need to be tough on crime. And I'm hearing what I perceive as some super predator talk, right? And right. We can't do that. We cannot afford to do that. As a party of Democrats, we need to shape this conversation that we're about public safety. And the way you get to that is by making sure people are getting the services that they need.
When you talk about the job being extremely hard, one of the things that occurs to me that might be extremely hard is like earning the respect of prosecutors in your office. And mm-hmm. I don't know anything. Maybe prosecutors across Hennepin County think you're great because you're definitely smart. You know what you're talking about. You're straightforward. So maybe that's not a problem. But I was watching a local news segment on John Choi, and one of his prosecutors was leaving to go to Arizona or something, just disagreed with the policies of the office. So, I mean, you could have things like that happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of prosecutors. They're not all going to like you. How do you earn the respect of people who answer to you, who may not agree with you?
That was true in the public defender's office, too. I mean, I grew up in that office. And so as a lawyer, I had differing opinions about people there, but I went into that office promising myself I was going to give everybody a clean slate. I've actually met with some prosecutors from the county attorney's office. People do have questions, legitimately so, like, what am I going to do? And I think from what I've heard, many prosecutors there do want to be doing something different. They're tired of prosecuting drug possession crimes. They do want to do wage theft and other things. But, you know, with any change comes uncertainty. And one of the things that somebody said to me was, well, people are afraid you're going to fire all of us. We've all seen Philly DA. And at that time, I hadn't seen it. It's the documentary about Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. And I went out and I watched it. But one of the things I said to this person was, that's not my style. And by the way, you're in a union, so that would never happen. I'm very pro-union, but it's not my style at all. My job is to set forth my vision, do appropriate training, and then there's got to be accountability. And I expect there are people who will jump right on board. This is something they're looking for. I expect there are some people who may leave because it's not what they want. And there are probably a bunch of people in the middle who just wonder what I'm going to do. And so I think earning their respect is about being transparent with them, about being, you know, one of the things I did here too is they want to know if you even agree with prosecution, which was an interesting question. Are you just going to turn us into a public defender's office? And I'm not even sure what that looks like. But I clearly understand the different roles. And I believe in public safety, but I approach public safety in a very evidence-based way. And so I've got to be transparent. I've got to make sure that I have their backs. That's a huge thing for somebody coming in. Not that I can't disagree with them internally, but that I will fight if there are issues with judges, as I did at the public defender's office, and work hard and try to create an atmosphere. I should take a step back too. One thing I did at the public defender's office was bring in facilitators and trainers about secondary trauma for our staff because that's something that a lot of people don't think about, all the trauma that you absorb from interacting with people who have had trauma their entire lives. And the same thing is, I'm sure, true of the prosecutors. And that has to be addressed too. And that's one of the reasons why I think this office needs to be led by a career trial lawyer. I've tried lots of cases. I've tried murder cases. I understand what it's like to be them. And so I want to make sure they are healthy and in a good place and understanding what may be happening to them, because what you don't want, and this is true in public defense too, is for people to get cynical. You want people to feel like they're empowered. They have the tools that they need to do what they need to do. And so I'm just going to have to work hard and be clear about my expectations. And I also believe, because I know this to be true, that people who are good at what they do look around, and if somebody isn't accountable, it's a morale killer. So you have to hold people accountable. And I did that at the public defender's office, and I would do that at the prosecutor's office as well.
Here's the thing that scares me is how big Hennepin County is. I'm used to thinking about like city council races and wards. Like a Minneapolis ward is about 30,000 people. And you're running in Hennepin County, which means there's any number of cities and all kinds of different people. And people in Minnetonka are probably up in arms about people rifling through their cars. Like, that's a big deal in Minnetonka, I think. And not a thing anyone in Minneapolis would care about. And they probably are like, Hennepin County attorney, do something about the people who opened my unlocked car door and like stole some change from my car. And that's a big deal to them. So how do you navigate the diverse interests of Hennepin County and different visions for prosecution and criminal justice?
I've had those conversations. And they're different. I mean, and I do have to say, you know, Minnetonka has a mask mandate. You know, a lot of these cities, there are people who are very progressive, who do want something different. And what I've found in my conversations with people who are delegates, that kind of thing, even the people who are against the charter amendment will say, we need police reform. I didn't like the charter amendment because of whatever my reasons were, but we need change. I just don't know what it looks like. And so that's my job, to talk to them about my vision for what it looks like. And when I do talk to them, they say, well, that sounds really reasonable to me. And so, yes, there are people concerned about the stuff that you talk about. You know, I think it's just understanding and listening to people that things have changed where they live. And, you know, my focus is certainly on keeping people safe. And perhaps it's talking to police in that particular city about issues, but I suspect they already know about them. But it's listening to police, city council members, and school board members. I've talked to a lot of school board members, city council members from Hennepin County. And really, at least listening to what they're hearing, what they want, what they need in their community. I'll actually say mostly what I've heard is that people want help, especially police, with mental health services in the suburbs. That's what I've actually heard a lot of, too. While I do know, I certainly have had an earful from people who are thinking of moving someplace else. You know, I don't know what I can do. I can't probably do something about that. And so I have to accept my limitations and explain to them, I'm running for the position of county attorney. Here's what's within my purview and here's what isn't. So I think I have to be really open and honest about what I can do and what I can't do.
Do you want to bring a cat on? I think it's the end of the show. We can bring a cat out or something. Oh. If there's a cat, if you have a cat handy. You can hold a cat up to the screen because this is YouTube.
I know. So
people want to turn on YouTube, they can see the cat.
You know what I did?
What'd you do?
I cheated a little bit. I have treats.
Oh.
And so I bribed them. So they are both here. We have one.
What's this one's name?
This one's name is Alegria, or Allie for short. She was often seen on Chauvin commentary. Okay. She joined me. And then this one is Sersha. They're both rescue cats from Pet Haven. They want to join the Wedge Cat Tour, but... Well,
what neighborhood are you in?
Armitage.
Okay, you're too far. Too far south.
I know. I did think about putting them in a car and bringing them to the Wedge, but they don't travel well.
That could be a good campaign stunt in the summer.
Only Mary if you're Moriarty still having the Wedge Tour or the Cat Tour.
Yeah, I have threatened to cancel it. We won't get into that. But speaking of Chauvin commentary, do you have any thoughts about Joe Tamburino? Can I ask you that? Is that too hot?
I went to law school with Joe. My cat's sitting on my computer. One moment here. I did see Joe. Joe was a public defender at one point.
Really?
Yes, I know you have that reaction. I have enjoyed your coverage of Joe.
Okay.
I did see him in court, and I said, Joe, this was a couple of years ago, I'm surprised to see you in court. And he said, why? I said, you're still doing defense work. And he said, why? And I said, well, I follow your commentary in the paper, and I was just kind of surprised you're doing defense work. I will say I was displaying a bit of too much dry humor, and he kind of took me seriously. And I'll just say I think he's enjoying his role as a commentator. And just substantively, actually, I wish that he is a defense lawyer, and there are some things that he has said in the paper that are not what I would expect from a defense lawyer. In fact, I remember one time he was arguing, or actually I was on the elliptical. I remember this. I saw an article. I was still chief. I was on the elliptical, and I saw an early article where he was quoted as saying that the police should just lock up people on low-level offenses for PC holds, probable cause holds, which means they could just arrest people without charges, and then when the hold expires, they're released. And he was just advocating for that, and the newspaper reporter had nothing in response to that. So I called the reporter, and I said, you don't have any opposite, any balanced view here, and that's actually unconstitutional. And he said, well, will you say something about it? And I said, well, yeah, it's unconstitutional. You can't just hold people to punish them just because, to teach them a lesson or whatever it was. And so they added that, and then they went back and talked to Joe, and he said, well, I didn't mean to imply that I meant anything unconstitutional. So, Joe's a nice guy. I think he gets a little carried away sometimes in his new role as a commentator.
It's good to end the podcast on a Tamburino note. Thank you for that. Thank you for humoring me. I'm obsessed with Joe Tamburino.
I know you are.
Let's plug the caucuses. February 1st, right?
Yes, but they're not actually happening in person. So one thing our team is doing and has been, we have just a terrific team, and they've been working so hard, and I've been making calls to delegates. What we are doing is making sure that people understand it's what the DFL calls contactless, which means nobody will actually appear at caucus. All people have to do is fill out an electronic form. What won't be happening is discussion and voting. If there are more people that want to be delegates to the county convention, they will be announcing a live Zoom public event where they will randomly draw sheets for, delegates. So what we've been doing, and this is really easy. Anybody who wants to caucus for me can go right on my website. There's a form on the upper right-hand side. It says caucus. There's a form. All you need to do is fill out the form and click it, and our team will take care of the rest. So we've made the process really easy.
And that website?
Mary, M-A-R-Y, for, F-O-R, Hennepin.com.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think that's it. I think we're done, right?
I don't know. I have more cats back.
I'm pretty sure we're done. You have to get out there and start campaigning, I think. That's what I've been told.
Yes, I have to call delegates. Delegates and fundraising, that's been the life lately. So yes, I do enjoy talking to people because, as you say, you know, I get to hear what people are thinking about all over the county, get to have these really good conversations with people. And our team has just been really great too. We've been working really hard. So I feel really good approaching precinct caucus.
Okay, this has been the Wedge Live Podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards. My guest has been candidate for Hennepin County Attorney, Mary Moriarty. Thank you for listening.
This is a real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this.
Going on today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. Right now.